From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
North Oakland.
Temescal.
Alamo Square.
I live in Noe Valley.
Corona Heights.
Western Addition.
I live in North Oakland, right by MacArthur BART Station.
Coming up, we'll hear why sanctuary cities that protect undocumented immigrants are safer than those that don't.
When local authorities do take up that role of immigration enforcement more directly, it undermines their ability to solve crimes.
Then we'll talk about a crime that's hard to spot, labor trafficking.
When you quit your job, those should not be the conditions under which you quit your job, is to feel like you have to run away and be scared for your life.
And we'll hear from an immigrant about her first day in the U.S.
The most exciting moment that I remember of my arrival was seeing the Manhattan skyline as we drove from JFK to New Jersey.
Coming to America. That's today on Cross Currents. When San Francisco resident Kate Steinle was shot and killed on Pier 14, the story became more than the death of one woman. It became a symbolic incident highlighting controversies around sanctuary cities. Around 200 state and local jurisdictions throughout the country are designated as sanctuaries. San Francisco has been one since 1989. Sanctuary cities are meant to protect undocumented immigrants from being held in detention or deported. It also means that if an undocumented immigrant commits a crime, the sheriff's department is not required to turn them over to federal immigration agents unless there's a warrant from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. The man who allegedly shot Steinle is an undocumented immigrant from Mexico. He had been deported from the U.S. multiple times, and he had 7 felonies on his record. In fact, he'd been sent from federal prison to San Francisco on a decades-old felony marijuana charge. But when that charge was dropped, the sheriff's department released him. ICE issued a detention request with a plan to deport him, but because it was not a warrant, San Francisco refused to hold him per sanctuary city policy. That was then. This is now. Kate Steinle's family is suing San Francisco Sheriff Ross Mercurimi and Immigration and Customs Enforcement for negligence. And the case has raised the question of whether sanctuary cities are safe. Reporter Josh Harkinson explored that question in a recent report from Mother Jones. He sat down to talk about it with KALW's Hannah Baba.
All right, so can you give us a bit of background on what a sanctuary city is? What does that mean?
A sanctuary city is a place where the local authorities have decided that if they apprehend somebody for a crime, and they are undocumented immigrants, they will not pursue that through the legal system. Mm-hmm. They won't refer that person to the federal authorities for deportation.
And why?
Because they believe the argument for sanctuary cities, among other things, is that immigrant communities will be afraid to cooperate with the police if they believe that doing so may cause them to get deported.
Mm. When did San Francisco become a sanctuary city, and what led up to that?
San Francisco enacted its sanctuary city law in 1989. And then in 2013, it amended it to make it even broader, to basically cover even repeat felons. As for why, I wasn't following this back in the 80s, but, I can only assume it was for the same reason that other cities did, which is that, the city was seeing a lot of immigration, and it was, and I think it, the sort of the impetus came from both activists who represented immigrants and immigrant communities, as well as law enforcement, based on their own experience, working with these communities and trying to develop a good relationship of trust.
Mm. Well, your reporting has shown what in terms of the safety of sanctuary cities? What did you find?
Well, if you take a step back, I mean, obviously, this one crime was tragic and may not have occurred if not for this policy. But in a general sense, evidence suggests that cities with these sanctuary laws are safer than those without them. And you can look at that from a number of different angles. I mean, homicides in San Francisco, for example, they in the year around the time that San Francisco passed its sanctuary law 26 years ago, the number of murders in the city was around 73 in 1989, and then last year it was 45. And you've seen the murder rate in the city decline for years. So I don't think that shows that this law made San Francisco more dangerous. The question is, did it make it safer? And, you know, you can look at also crimes in California overall, murders in California. In the state, most cities in California have sanctuary laws, and the state has a sanctuary law. And that has declined as well. Mm. Of course, crime in the United States as a whole has also gone down in recent decades. So you could say, oh, well, it's just, you know, part of this larger trend. It's not related. So I think those bits of evidence suggest that these laws may make us safer, and they at least don't make us less safe.
And do you think the other side is going to buy that? Why do you think the sanctuary city status is being, you know, questioned and attacked so hard?
Well, I think it's an emotional issue above all else. I mean, when somebody gets killed on the streets, we naturally look for answers as to why. And I think that this is a sort of easy thing to seize upon to explain that. And it plays also into these deep-seated fears of the other, of, you know, of immigrant communities, of people that we may not be familiar with, that we may fear for other reasons. So I think that's why this is getting attention. It's not because people have really taken a detailed look at the statistics behind crime.
So what do you know about San Francisco in particular in terms of its sanctuary city status? Is there any, like, has this case brought about any discussions that you know about, or?
Well, I think it's brought about a lot of discussions in the realm of city government. I know that Mayor Ed Lee kind of distanced himself from the way that the sheriff, Ross Mercurimi, handled this. And I'm not deep in that world of local San Francisco politics, but I do think that there is a fear among some elected leaders that they might get dragged down by this, and they're playing it very cautiously.
Okay. Yeah. Anything else you want to say about kind of what people should know about sanctuary cities?
So there was a study in 2013 by the Department of Urban Planning and Policy at the University of Illinois. And basically it surveyed Latinos living in major cities like Chicago and Los Angeles and Phoenix. And it found that the increased involvement of local police and immigration enforcement in those places had eroded the trust of these communities in the legal system. And basically about 45% of immigrants said that they felt like they were they were less likely to report a crime as a result of this. And 70% of undocumented immigrants said so. So it's just another example of how when local authorities do take up that role of immigration enforcement more directly, it undermines their ability to solve crimes. And the most pronounced loss of trust was in Phoenix, where, of course, Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arapio has put these really strict immigration enforcement policies in place. So I think that, you know, the takeaway here is that people need to take a step back, not just have this emotional gut reaction, and think about this from a broader perspective.
That was reporter Josh Harkinson from Mother Jones speaking with KALW's Hannah Baba. Find links to his reporting on sanctuary cities at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. It's one of crime's most hidden industries, human trafficking. It's often called modern-day slavery. With an estimated 20 million victims around the world, traffickers use sexual exploitation, fraud, and forced labor to keep victims powerless. Since 2010, the state of California has investigated thousands of trafficking cases and arrested nearly 2,000 people. It's happening all around us, sometimes in plain sight, in restaurants, on a street corner. But it's hard to prosecute these crimes. Victims often don't come forward because of threats from traffickers. Today, reporter Leela Day brings us one man's story.
Sonny is sitting on a bench in Golden Gate Park. He smiles when I see him. His eyes are dark, his flannel shirt well-pressed.
I like it to be a fisherman. Especially, I like fishes.
The name Sonny suits him well. Light and uplifting. But it isn't his real name. He chose to use an alias and a translator, even though he speaks English. He wants to make sure the details are right.
So, what, more or less, what were you making as a fisherman in Indonesia?
Kalau untuk kapal lokal,
about $150 every month.
Every month. Kalau untuk yang
if I work in a foreign ship, it will be $350 per month.
So you prefer to work for a foreign ship?
Yeah.
Sonny lives here in San Francisco now, a long way from Central Java, where he grew up fishing. For 6 years, he worked on foreign ships, Japanese fishing companies that hired crews from different parts of Indonesia. Fishing is fast-paced work, repetitive.
So every day, I throw 2,000 hooks. So when we were setting the hook, it'll take us about 6 hours.
Sonny took a break from the work after his wife had their first son. When he was ready to go back, he called a local recruitment agency in Indonesia. They organized contract work for fishermen. Sonny says they helped him find work in the past, and they did it again.
They said that they're going to pay me $300 US every month.
Recruitment agencies like this one are common in Indonesia. There are more than 500 of them. Sonny signed a contract to work for 2 years in Hawaii, and a few weeks later, he boarded a plane.
And then from Australia to Fiji, flying. From Fiji to Western Samoa, flying again. From Western Samoa to American Samoa, flying again. From there, a ship picked me up.
From Samoa, Sonny switched to a smaller boat and was told that a different employment agency would get him his visa. He waited for the fishing ship and waited.
Kami nggak diberi makan.
Within that 3 days, they didn't give us food. So I was looking for food myself.
Where did you find food? How did you eat?
Terus di mana Anda cari makannya?
Saya minta-minta ke kapal yang lain karena.
Oh, so I asked from other ship, folks from other ships, and because it's a fisherman solidarity, they give us food.
For 2 weeks, they waited. More people boarded from the Philippines and Indonesia.
So this boat was really, really crowded.
When he finally was transferred, it was to a boat that wasn't mentioned in his contract. The captain took his passport and everyone else's. They started sailing towards Hawaii.
I start working at 2 p.m.
Sampai jam 3 malam.
Till 3 a.m. nonstop.
Sonny pushed himself hard. His contract promised him a bonus for every ton of fish he pulled in, $250 US on top of his salary. But Sonny wasn't getting his bonuses. So from the boat, he called the agency that hired him back in Indonesia.
Padahal saya punya,
I had three numbers, cell phone, office, etc. None of the phones actually were working.
This is happening to Sonny. It's probably happening to a lot of other people.
That's Cindy Liu, an attorney at the Asian Pacific Islander Legal Outreach Center. Liu says she's heard of this disappearing agency situation.
I've had many Filipino clients recruited through these labor agencies in the Philippines, and they also incur a huge debt before they come over to the U.S., only to find out the jobs that are promised is something else, the conditions are different, and they call that agency back home, and it's, all of a sudden it doesn't exist or it's gone.
Lou says most media coverage focuses on sex trafficking, but labor trafficking is an increasing problem. But it's only fairly recently that the U.S. even passed labor trafficking laws. Many cases never go to court. People just want to move on.
Most of our clients, again, their primary goals are to be safe and to be stabilized and usually to support their families in some way. It's the first thing that's on their mind is not usually, let me think about how I can go lock somebody up or how I can go sue somebody.
Sonny never considered breaking his contract. That would have meant a $1,000 fine, and that's almost 4 months of work. He needed the money. He had a daughter to think about back in Java. For about 17 days, he traveled east toward San Francisco. On the boat, things got worse. Some fishermen were Muslim, but they served a lot of pork for dinner, so Sonny wasn't eating much. If you look at Sonny's hands, you'll see that one of his fingers is crooked and scarred. While he's talking, he sometimes puts one hand over the other to hide it.
So my finger at the time is almost broken.
Saya bilang sama kapten, saya perlu dokter untuk mengobati jari saya.
Yeah, I told him I need a doctor.
There was no doctor on board, and the pain grew more intense. The vessel docked in San Francisco, and that's when Sonny saw a chance to run.
So the night before I took the passport, they were drinking, so they were all drunk. And this is a good time for me to just snuck in and just get my passport. So my friend also agreed, so we say, okay, let's go get our passport and leave.
Sonny didn't have any idea where to go. He bought a calling card and phoned Indonesia. His family searched on Facebook to see if there were Indonesians near Sonny who could help, and they found someone. Eventually, a pastor contacted him.
Saya ceritakan semuanya sama dia.
I told the pastor everything.
Habis itu dia mencoba membantu.
And then he tried to help.
Siapa-siapa yang bisa membantu saya. Yeah.
Sonny ended up at the Asian Women's Shelter in San Francisco, where they helped him with food and clothing and took him to the hospital. But like most domestic violence shelters in the city, this one was only for women. So the organization convinced the Indonesian consulate to pay for Sonny to stay in a hotel instead of a homeless shelter. They also connected him with his lawyer. Finally, things started to change.
Kalau saya pikir kembali, saya waktu itu, saya kayak diperbudak.
When I think about it, I felt like I was being enslaved.
Karena gaji saya dibayar tidak sesuai dengan agreement.
Because my salary was not according to the agreement.
Sedangkan bekerja 20 jam itu sungguh keterlaluan buat saya.
And working 20 hours, that's way too much. That's way too injustice, too unjust.
Today, Sonny's got a work visa. In 5 years, he can apply for a green card. He lives with his wife and now two children in San Francisco, not far from Golden Gate Park.
Anak saya, dia udah pergi sekolah. Dia juga senang karena ketemu saya setelah yeah. bertahun-tahun gak ketemu.
My daughter goes to school and she's happy to be together because we haven't seen each other for a long time.
The captain was never prosecuted. And Sonny's not interested in pursuing it. He now works in a liquor store where he makes $13 an hour. And he has no plans to return to sea. For Cross Currents, I'm Leela Day.
That story first aired in January 2014. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. There are more immigrants living in the U.S. now than ever before, over 40 million. Today, we're beginning a series bringing you stories of what it's like when someone first comes to this country. This is the premiere of our series, First Days. The first days are full of excitement, loss, adventure, anticipation, and they're unforgettable. Here's Shabba Tharoor Srinivasan, who immigrated to the U.S. from Calcutta, India in 1979.
I arrived at JFK Airport from London Heathrow on a Saturday in August after having spent a few days in England with my uncle and a week in Geneva with my brother and his wife. My parents felt that since this was the first time that I was leaving India, it might be wise to give me an opportunity to acclimatize myself in the Western world while still in the company of family. A close friend of mine had asked his cousin who lived in New Jersey to pick me up from the airport, so I was met by two kind strangers who were gracious and welcoming. They picked me up in their station wagon and drove me home to a delicious chicken curry and rice dinner. The most exciting moment that I remember of my arrival was seeing the Manhattan skyline as we drove from JFK to New Jersey. As a student of literature and a lover of books, I was familiar with New York stories, and I had goosebumps when I saw the tall buildings of my favorite city. I came to America on a scholarship to a liberal arts college called Elmira in upstate New York to study English literature. It is on the grounds of Elmira College where Mark Twain's Octagonal Study is located. As a student of literature, whether English or American, to be where the great American author and humorist penned his masterpieces like Huckleberry Finn was indeed a remarkable blessing.
That was Shabba Tharoor Srinivasan, interviewed by Fariz Baca. First Days is a collaboration with the South Asian American Digital Archive. To hear more of these stories from the First Days Project, go to kalw.org. Today, we've heard from people whose stories don't always get out there. Now, we'd love to hear yours. Email us at news@kalw.org or call 415-264-7106. Share your story at 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we are listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Geraldine Asu, Hannah Baba, Audrey Dilling, Tammy Drummond, Catherine Girardeau, Bernice Friedom, Angela Johnston, Liz Mack, Holly J. McDeed, Casey Miner, James Rollins, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Line producer was Leela Day. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Yasir Chadli. This native of Casablanca has lived in the U.S. since 1977, during which time he has performed with blues, jazz, and Latin performers, as well as practicing traditional Moroccan music. Yasir Chadli has an outdoor concert scheduled this Thursday at Yerba Buena Gardens in San Francisco. It's free and starts at 12:30 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefner.
Yeah, 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 yeah.